The book is The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. This is Chapter 5, Moondread. The object of this paper, the report began, is to investigate the means whereby we could continue to fight single-handed if French resistance were to collapse completely, involving the loss of a substantial portion of the British Expeditionary Force, and the French government were to make terms with Germany. Labeled Most Secret, it made for a frightening read. One of its fundamental assumptions was that the United States would provide full economic and financial support. Without this, the report noted in italics, we do not think we could continue the war with any chance of success. It forecast that only a fragment of the BEF could be evacuated from France. The overriding fear was that if the French did capitulate, Hitler would turn his armies and air force against England. Germany, the report said, has ample forces to invade and occupy this country. Should the enemy succeed in establishing a force with its vehicles firmly ashore, the army in the United Kingdom, which is very short of equipment, has not got the offensive power to drive it out. Everything depended on whether our fighter defenses will be able to reduce the scale of attack to reasonable bounds. Britain's energies were to be concentrated on the production of fighters, the training of crews, and the defense of aircraft factories. The crux of the whole problem is the air defense of this country. If France fell, the report said, the task would be immeasurably more difficult. Previous plans for homeland defense were based on the assumption, the certainty, that the Luftwaffe would be flying from bases within Germany and would thus have limited ability to penetrate deep into England. But now British strategists had to face the prospect of German fighters and bombers taking off from airfields along the French coast, just minutes from the English shore, and from bases in Belgium, Holland, Denmark, and Norway. These bases, the report said, would allow Germany to concentrate a very heavy weight of long- and short-range bomber attack over a large area of this country. A central question was whether the British public would be able to endure what was sure to be a furious assault by the full force of Germany's air force. The morale of the country, the report warned, will be subjected to a heavier strain than ever before. The authors, however, found reason to believe that the people's morale would hold if they realize, as they are beginning to do, that the existence of the empire is at stake. It was time, the report said, to inform the public of the true dangers that confront us. London seemed certain to be Hitler's primary target. In a 1934 speech to the House of Commons, Churchill himself had called it the greatest target in the world, a kind of tremendous, fat, valuable cow tied up to attract the beast of prey. After one cabinet meeting, Churchill led his ministers out to the street and with a grim half-smile told them, "Take a good look round. I expect all these buildings will look very different in 2 or 3 weeks' time." Even the report from the chiefs of staff, gloomy as it was, did not envision the rapid and complete collapse already underway across the Channel. With a German victory in France nearly certain, British intelligence now forecast that Germany might invade England immediately without waiting for a formal French surrender. The British expected that an invasion would begin with a titanic onslaught by the German Air Force, potentially a knockout blow, or as Churchill called it, an aerial banquet, with as many as 14,000 aircraft darkening the sky. British strategists believed that the Luftwaffe had 4 times as many aircraft as the RAF. Germany's 3 main bombers, the Junkers Ju-88, the Dornier Do-17, and the Heinkel He-111 carried bomb loads ranging from 2,000 to 8,000 pounds, more than could have been imagined in the prior war. One aircraft was particularly fearsome, the Stuka, its name a contraction of the German word for dive bomber, Sturzkampfflugzeug. The plane looked like a giant bent-wing insect and was equipped with an apparatus, the Jericho Trompette, that caused it to emit a terrifying shriek while diving. It could place bombs up to 5 at a time with far more precision than a standard aircraft and had terrified Allied troops during Germany's Blitzkrieg attacks. As British planners saw it, Germany possessed the ability to bomb England to the point where it might have no other option but to surrender, an outcome contemplated long before by theorists of aerial warfare who saw strategic bombing or terror bombing as a means of subduing an enemy. Germany's bombing of Rotterdam had seemed to validate such thinking. The day after the Luftwaffe's attack, the Dutch surrendered out of fear that other cities would be destroyed. England's ability to defend itself from this kind of campaign depended entirely on the nation's aircraft industry's capacity to produce fighter aircraft, Hurricanes and Spitfires, at a rate high enough not just to compensate for the fast mounting losses, but also to increase the overall number of planes available for combat. Fighters alone in no way could win the war, although Churchill believed that with enough aircraft, England might be able to hold Hitler at bay and stave off invasion long enough for the United States to enter the war. But fighter production lagged. England's aircraft plants operated on a pre-war schedule that did not take into account the new reality of having a hostile force based just across the channel. Production, though increasing, was suppressed by the fusty practices of a peacetime bureaucracy only now awakening to the realities of total war. Shortages of parts and materials disrupted production. Damaged aircraft accumulated as they awaited repair. Many nearly completed planes lacked engines and instruments. Vital parts were stored in far-flung locations, jealously guarded by feudal officials, reserving them for their own future needs. With all this in mind, Churchill, on his first day as Prime Minister, created an entirely new ministry devoted solely to the production of fighters and bombers, the Ministry of Aircraft Production. In Churchill's view, this new ministry was the only thing that could save Britain from defeat, and he was confident that he knew just the man to run it, his longtime friend and occasional antagonist, Max Aitken, Lord Beaverbrook, a man who drew controversy the way steeples draw lightning. Churchill offered him the job that night, but Beaverbrook demurred. He had made his fortune in newspapers and knew nothing about running factories that manufactured products as complex as fighters and bombers. Moreover, his health was impaired. He was plagued by eye troubles and asthma, so much so that he devoted a room in his London mansion, Stornoway House, to asthma treatments and filled it with kettles to produce steam. 2 weeks from turning 61, he had pulled back from direct management of his newspaper empire and was intent on spending more time at his villa at Cap d'Ail on the southeast coast of France, though Hitler had killed this plan for the time being. Beaverbrook's secretaries were still composing draft letters of refusal when, on the evening of May 12th, apparently on impulse, he accepted the post. He became Minister of Aircraft Production 2 days later. Churchill understood Beaverbrook and knew on an instinctive level that he was the man to jolt awake the still slumbering aircraft industry. He also understood that Beaverbrook could be difficult, would be difficult, and anticipated that he would spark conflict, but it did not matter. As one American visitor put it, the PM, who has the most kindly feelings toward Beaverbrook, looked at him as an indulgent parent would to a small boy at a party who had said something not quite appropriate, but made no comment. There was more to Churchill's decision, however. Churchill needed Beaverbrook's presence as a friend to provide counsel on matters beyond aircraft production. Despite later hagiography, Churchill did not and frankly could not manage the staggering pressure of directing the war by himself. He relied heavily on others, even if sometimes these others merely served as an audience on whom he could test his thoughts and plans. Beaverbrook could be counted on for candor at all times and to deliver advice without regard for politics or personal feelings. Where Pug Ismay was a calming and cooling influence, Beaverbrook was gasoline. He was also wildly entertaining, a trait that Churchill loved and needed. Ismay sat quietly, ready to offer advice and counsel. Beaverbrook enlivened every room he entered. On occasion, he called himself Churchill's court jester. Canadian by birth, Beaverbrook had moved to England before the previous war. In 1916, he bought the moribund Daily Express, and over time, he grew its circulation sevenfold to 2.5 million, cementing his reputation as an ingenious maverick. Beaverbrook enjoyed being provocative, wrote Virginia Cowles, a prominent chronicler of life in wartime England, who worked for Beaverbrook's Evening Standard. Complacency was as tempting a target to him as a balloon to a small boy with a pin, Cowles remarked. Beaverbrook and Churchill had been friends for 3 decades, though the intimacy of their connection had tended to wax and wane. To the many people who disliked Beaverbrook, his physical appearance seemed a metaphor for his personality. He stood 5 feet 9 inches, 3 inches taller than Churchill. With a broad upper body over narrow hips and slender legs, there was something about this combination, tied with his wide and wickedly gleeful smile, his overly large ears and nose, and a scattering of facial moles, that inclined people to describe him as smaller than he was, like some malignant elf from a fairy tale. American General Raymond Lee, stationed in London as an observer, called him a violent, passionate, malicious, and dangerous little goblin. Lord Halifax nicknamed him the Toad. A few behind his back referred to him as the Beaver. Clementine, in particular, nursed a deep mistrust of Beaverbrook. "My darling," she wrote to Churchill, "try ridding yourself of this microbe which some people fear is in your blood. Exorcise this bottle imp and see if the air is not clearer and purer." As a rule, however, women found Beaverbrook attractive. His wife, Gladys, died in 1927, and both during and after their marriage, he conducted numerous affairs. He loved gossip, and thanks to his female friends and his network of reporters, he knew many of the secrets of London's uppermost strata. Max never seems to tire of the shabby drama of some men's lives, their infidelities and their passions, wrote his doctor, Charles Wilson, now also Churchill's physician. One of Beaverbrook's most impassioned enemies, Minister of Labour Ernest Bevin, deployed a gritty analogy to describe the relationship between Churchill and Beaverbrook. "He's like a man who's married a whore. He knows she's a whore, but he loves her just the same." Churchill saw the relationship in succinct terms. "Some take drugs," he said. "I take Max." He recognized that by removing the responsibility for aircraft production from the long-established Air Ministry and giving it to Beaverbrook, he was laying the groundwork for a clash of territorial interests. But he failed to anticipate just how much outright bickering Beaverbrook would immediately generate and how great a source of exasperation this would become. The writer, Evelyn Waugh, whose comic novel Scoop was thought by some to have been inspired by Beaverbrook, though Waugh denied it, once said that he found himself compelled to believe in the devil, if only to account for the existence of Lord Beaverbrook. The stakes were indeed high. It was as dark a picture as any Britain has ever faced, wrote David Ferrer, one of Beaverbrook's many secretaries. Beaverbrook embraced his new task with relish. He loved the idea of being at the center of power and loved even more the prospect of disrupting the lives of hidebound bureaucrats. He launched his new ministry from his own mansion and staffed its administrative side with employees pulled from his own newspapers. In a move unusual for the age, he also hired one of his editors to be his personal propaganda and public relations man. Intent on quickly transforming the aircraft industry, he recruited a collection of top business executives to be his senior lieutenants, including the general manager of a Ford Motor Company plant. He cared little about whether they had expertise with airplanes. "They are all captains of industry, and industry is like theology," Beaverbrook said. "If you know the rudiments of one faith, you can grasp the meaning of another. For my part, I would not hesitate to appoint the moderator of the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church to take over the duties of the Pope of Rome." Beaverbrook convened key meetings in his downstairs library, or, on fine days, outside on a balcony off his first-floor ballroom, the second floor in American parlance. His typists and secretaries worked upstairs wherever space permitted. The bathrooms had typewriters. Beds served as surfaces for arranging documents. No one left the premises for lunch. At the asking, food prepared by Beaverbrook's chef was delivered on trays. His own typical lunch was chicken, bread, and a pear. All employees were expected to work the same hours he did, meaning 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. He could be unrealistically demanding. One of his most senior men complained about how Beaverbrook gave him an assignment at 2 a.m, then called back at 8 a.m. to see how much had been accomplished. After a personal secretary, George Malcolm Thompson, took an unscheduled morning off, Beaverbrook left him a note. "Tell Thompson that Hitler will be here if he doesn't look out." Beaverbrook's valet, Albert Knuckles, once countered his shouted command, "For God's sake, hurry up," with the rejoinder, "My lord, I am not a spitfire." No matter their value, fighters were still only defensive weapons. Churchill also wanted a steep increase in the production of bombers. He saw these as the only means currently at hand for bringing the war directly to Hitler. For the time being, Churchill had to rely on the RAF's fleet of medium bombers, though 2 4-engine heavy bombers were nearing introduction, the Stirling and the Halifax, named for a town in Yorkshire, not for Lord Halifax, each with the capacity to carry up to 14,000 pounds of bombs well into Germany. Churchill acknowledged that Hitler was, for the time being, free to project his forces in whatever direction he wished, be it eastward or into Asia and Africa. "But there is one thing that will bring him back and bring him down," Churchill wrote in a minute to Beaverbrook, "and that is an absolutely devastating, exterminating attack by very heavy bombers from this country upon the Nazi homeland. We must be able to overwhelm them by this means, without which I do not see a way through." In his own hand, Churchill added, "We cannot accept any lower aim than air mastery. When will it be obtained?" Churchill's Minister of Aircraft Production proceeded with the exuberance of an impresario even designing a special flag for the radiator of his car with MAP in red against a blue background. British aircraft plants began turning out fighters at a rate that no one, least of all German intelligence, could have foreseen, and under circumstances that factory managers had never imagined. The prospect of invasion forced citizens at all levels of British society to contemplate exactly what invasion would mean, not as an abstraction, but as something that could happen as you sat at your table reading the Daily Express or knelt in your garden pruning your rose bushes. Churchill was convinced that one of Hitler's first goals would be to kill him, with the expectation that whatever government replaced his would be more willing to negotiate. He insisted on keeping a Bren light machine gun in the trunk of his car, having vowed on numerous occasions that if the Germans came for him, he would take as many as possible with him to the grave. He often carried a revolver, and often misplaced it, according to Inspector Thompson. From time to time, Thompson recalled, Churchill would abruptly brandish his revolver and, roguishly and with delight, exclaim, "You see, Thompson, they will never take me alive. I will get one or two before they can shoot me down." But he was also ready for worse. According to one of his typists, Mrs. Hill, he embedded a capsule containing cyanide in the cap of his fountain pen. Harold Nicholson, parliamentary secretary for the Ministry of Information, and his wife, writer Vita Sackville-West, began working out the nitty-gritty details of coping with an invasion, as if preparing for a winter storm. "You will have to get the Buick in a fit state to start with a full petrol tank," Nicholson wrote. "You should put inside it some food for 24 hours, and pack in the back your jewels and my diaries. You will want clothes and anything else very precious, but the rest will have to be left behind." Vita lived at the couple's country home, Sissinghurst, just 20 miles from the Strait of Dover, the narrowest point between England and France, and thus a likely pathway for amphibious assault. Nicholson recommended that when the invasion came, Vito should drive to Devonshire, 5 hours west. "This all sounds very alarming," he added, "but it would be foolish to pretend that the danger is inconceivable." The lovely weather only heightened the anxiety. It seemed as though nature were conspiring with Hitler, delivering a nearly uninterrupted chain of fine, warm days with calm waters in the channel, ideal for the shallow-hulled barges Hitler would need to land tanks and artillery. Writer Rebecca West described the unstained heaven of that perfect summer, when she and her husband walked in London's Regent's Park as barrage balloons, silver elephantines, drifted overhead. 562 of these giant oblong balloons were aloft over London, tethered by mile-long cables to block dive bombers and keep fighters from descending low enough to strafe the city's streets. West recalled how people sat in chairs among the roses, staring straight ahead, their faces white with strain. Some of them walked among the rose beds with a special earnestness, looking down on the bright flowers and inhaling the scent as if to say, "That is what roses are like. That is how they smell. We must remember that, down in the darkness." But even invasion fears could not wholly obliterate the sheer seductiveness of those late spring days. Anthony Eden, Churchill's new Secretary of War, tall, handsome, and as recognizable as a film star, went for a walk in St. James Park, sat on a bench, and took an hour-long nap. With France in precipitous collapse, air raids over England seemed certain, and the moon became a source of dread. The first full moon of Churchill's premiership occurred on Tuesday, May 21, imparting to the streets of London the cool pallor of candle wax. The German raid on Rotterdam lingered as a reminder of what could very soon befall the city. So likely was this prospect that 3 days later, on Friday, May 24, with the moon still bright, a waning gibbous, Tom Harrison, director of Mass Observation's network of social observers, sent a special message to his many diarists. In the case of air raids, observers will not be expected to stand about. It will be entirely satisfactory if observers take shelter, so long as they are able to take shelter with other people, preferably with a lot of other people. The opportunity for observing human behavior at its most raw was just too perfect. Chapter 6. Goering. On that Friday, May 24, Hitler made two decisions that would influence the duration and character of the coming war. At noon, on the advice of a trusted senior general, Hitler ordered his armored divisions to halt their advance against the British Expeditionary Force. Hitler agreed with the general's recommendation that his tanks and crews be given a chance to regroup before a planned advance to the south. German forces already had sustained major losses in the so-called campaign in the west. 27,074 soldiers dead, 111,034 more wounded, and another 18,384 missing, a blow to the German public, who had been led to expect a brief, tidy war. The halt order, which gave the British a life-saving pause, perplexed British and German commanders alike. The Luftwaffe's General Field Marshal, Albert Kesselring, later called it a fatal error. Kesselring was all the more surprised when suddenly the task of destroying the fleeing British force was assigned to him and his air fleet. Luftwaffe Chief Hermann Goering had promised Hitler that his air force could destroy the BEF on its own, a promise that had little grounding in reality, Kesselring knew, especially given the exhaustion of his pilots and the spirited attacks by RAF pilots flying the latest Spitfires. That same Friday, further swayed by Goering's belief in the near-magical power of his air force, Hitler issued Directive No. 13, one of a series of broad strategic orders he would issue throughout the war. The task of the air force will be to break all enemy resistance on the part of the surrounded forces to prevent the escape of the English forces across the channel, the directive read. It authorized the Luftwaffe to attack the England homeland in the fullest manner as soon as sufficient forces are available. Goering, large, buoyant, ruthless, cruel, had used his close connection to Hitler to win this commission, deploying the sheer strength of his ebullient and joyously corrupt personality to overcome Hitler's misgivings, at least for the time being. Although on paper Hitler's official number two man was Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess, not to be confused with Rudolf Höss, who ran Auschwitz, Goering was his favorite. Goering had built the Luftwaffe from nothing into the most powerful air force in the world. "When I talk with Goering, it's like a bath in steel for me," Hitler told Nazi architect Albert Speer. "I feel fresh afterward. The Reich Marshal has a stimulating way of presenting things." Hitler did not feel this way toward his official deputy. "With Hess," Hitler said, "every conversation becomes an unbearably tormenting strain. He always comes to me with unpleasant matters and won't leave off." When the war began, Hitler chose Goering to be his primary successor, with Hess next in line. In addition to the Air Force, Goering held enormous power over other realms within Germany, as evident in his many official titles: President of the Defense Council, Commissioner for the Four-Year Plan, President of the Reichstag, Prime Minister of Prussia, and Minister of Forests and Hunting, this last an acknowledgment of his personal love for medieval history. He had grown up on the grounds of a feudal castle that had turrets and walls with machicolations designed for the dispersion of stones and boiling oil onto any assailants below. According to one British intelligence report, in his childhood games, he always played the part of a robber knight or led the village boys in some imitation military maneuver. Goering held full control over German heavy industry. Another British assessment concluded that this man of abnormal ruthlessness and energy now holds almost all the threads of power in Germany. On the side, Goering ran a criminal empire of art dealers and thugs who provided him with a museum's worth of art that was either stolen or bought at coercively low price, much of it considered ownerless Jewish art, and confiscated from Jewish households. In all, 1,400 paintings, sculptures, and tapestries, including Van Gogh's Bridge at Langlois in Arles, and works by Renoir, Botticelli, and Monet. The term ownerless was a Nazi designation applied to works of art left behind by fleeing and deported Jews. In the course of the war, while ostensibly traveling a Luftwaffe business, Goering would visit Paris 20 times, often aboard one of his four special trains, to review the select works gathered by his agents at the Jeu de Paume, a museum in the Jardin des Tuileries. By the fall of 1942, he had acquired 596 works from this source alone. He displayed hundreds of his best pieces at Carenhall, his country home, and increasingly often his headquarters, named for his first wife, Karin, who had died in 1931. Paintings hung on the walls from floor to ceiling in multiple tiers that emphasized not their beauty and worth, but rather the acquisitiveness of their new owner. His demand for fine things, especially those rendered in gold, was fed as well by a kind of institutional larceny. Every year, his underlings were compelled to contribute money for the purchase of an expensive present for his birthday. Goering designed Carenhall to evoke a medieval hunting lodge and built it in an ancient forest 45 miles north of Berlin. He also erected an immense mausoleum on the grounds for the body of his late wife, framed with large sarsen stones that evoked the sandstone blocks at Stonehenge. He married again, an actress named Emmy Sonnemann, on April 10, 1935, in a ceremony at Berlin Cathedral attended by Hitler as formations of Luftwaffe bombers flew overhead. Goering also had a passion for extravagant sartorial display. He designed his own uniforms, the flashier the better, with medals and epaulets and silver filigree, often changing clothes multiple times in the course of a day. He was known to wear more eccentric costumes as well, including tunics, togas, and sandals, which he accented by painting his toenails red and applying makeup to his cheeks. On his right hand, he wore a large ring with 6 diamonds. On his left, an emerald said to be an inch square. He strode the grounds of Carenhall like an oversized Robin Hood in a belted jacket of green leather with a large hunting knife tucked into his belt and carrying a staff. One German general reported being summoned for a meeting with Goering and finding him sitting there dressed in the following way, a green silk shirt embroidered in gold with gold thread running through it, and a large monocle. His hair had been dyed yellow, his eyebrows were penciled, his cheeks rouged. He was wearing violet silk stockings and black patent leather pumps. He was sitting there looking like a jellyfish. To outside observers, Goering seemed to have a limited grip on sanity, but an American interrogator, General Carl Spatz, would later write that Goering, despite rumors to the contrary, is far from mentally deranged. In fact, he must be considered a very shrewd customer, a great actor and professional liar. The public loved him, forgiving his legendary excesses and coarse personality. The American correspondent, William Shirer, in his diary, sought to explain this seeming paradox. Where Hitler is distant, legendary, nebulous, an enigma as a human being, Goering is a salty, earthy, lusty man of flesh and blood. The Germans like him because they understand him. He has the faults and virtues of the average man, and the people admire him for both. He has a child's love for uniforms and medals. So have they. Shirer detected no resentment among the public directed toward the fantastic, medieval, and very expensive personal life he leads. It is the sort of life they would lead themselves, perhaps, if they had the chance. Goering was revered by the officers who served him, at first. "We swore by the Führer and worshipped Goering," wrote one bomber pilot, who attributed Goering's cachet to his performance in the prior war when he was a top ace, legendary for his courage. But some of his officers and pilots were now growing disenchanted. Behind his back, they began calling him the Fat One. One of his top fighter pilots, Adolf Galland, came to know him well and repeatedly clashed with him over tactics. Goering was easily influenced by a small clique of sycophants, Galland said. His court favorites changed frequently, since his favor could only be won and held by means of constant flattery, intrigue, and expensive gifts. More worrisome, in Galland's view, was that Goering seemed not to understand that aerial warfare had advanced radically since the prior war. Goering was a man with almost no technical knowledge and no appreciation of the conditions under which modern fighter aircraft fought. But Goering's worst error, according to Galland, was hiring a friend, Beppo Schmidt, to head the Luftwaffe's intelligence arm, responsible for determining the day-to-day strength of the British Air Force, an appointment soon to have grave consequences. Beppo Schmidt, Galland said, was a complete washout as intelligence officer, the most important job of all. Nonetheless, Goering paid attention only to him. He trusted Schmidt as a friend, but, more importantly, reveled in the happy news that he seemed always ready to provide. When Hitler turned to the daunting task of conquering Britain, naturally he came to Goering, and Goering was delighted. In the Western campaign, it was the army, especially its armored divisions, that won all the honors, with the Air Force playing a secondary role, providing ground support. Now the Luftwaffe would have its chance to achieve glory, and Goering had no doubt that it would prevail.